This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Welcome to this Anzac Day edition of the Law Report. I'm Damien Carrick. Today, a lateral look at legal issues related to the war on terror, how the CIA restricts access to information in the name of security. Also closer to home, freedom of information and the AWB scandal. But first, this Friday is the 10th anniversary of the Port Arthur massacre. You may have heard on recent media report programs, there's been a lot of debate about whether it's a good thing to mark a tragedy that claimed 35 lives and injured 19. Of course, the events of that chilling day are significant for another reason, gun control.
The greatest decision John Howard has made in his 10 years, and the most courageous. One only has to remember that picture at the rally in Victoria where you saw the outline of the flak jacket in the suit. It was personally courageous and politically courageous, and he deserves the applause of the Australian community for doing it.
Gary Bailey, editor of the Hobart Mercury newspaper. If anything good can be said to have come out of the Port Arthur tragedy, many Australians would argue that it was the restrictions on gun ownership, particularly semi-automatic long arms, the type of rifles used by Martin Bryant. Sam Lee, chair of the National Coalition for Gun Control, says that since the restrictions and the buyback, there has been a marked decrease in homicides and no mass shootings.
The laws were meant to restrict access and possession of firearms. They certainly had no intention of getting rid of all firearms. They did assist in taking away over 600,000 semi-automatic long arms from the community by buying those back. What we've seen since the implementation of the new laws is a reduction in homicides across Australia. We've seen a 47% decrease in homicides with the firearm across Australia, and also a 44% decrease in robberies with the firearm. We also haven't had a mass shooting since the new laws were introduced. We did have the Monash shooting, but in terms of massacres, the number of people that classifies as a massacre is three people being shot, and the Monash shooting, two people were shot.
So there hasn't been another Queen Street, another Hoddle Street, another Port Arthur, another Strathfield?
That's correct, yeah, which is obviously extremely positive.
How sure can we be, though, that that decline or that absence of massacres is to do with the increased restrictions on firearms? I think it was Don Weatherburn, who's a very highly respected crime statistician in New South Wales, suggested that the decline in, say, things like armed robberies and abductions may have more to do with the heroin drought than with the restrictions on guns.
Well, certainly you have to respect Don Weatherburn's import into this actual area. And there, obviously there are many variables that contribute towards firearms crime. But I believe there is a research coming out very shortly that does actually help to highlight that since the ban on semi-automatic long arms, there was a dramatic drop in homicides with the firearm across Australia. And research, particularly in the United States where the majority of research on firearms is done, it does definitely show that the less guns available in the community, the less likely someone will be shot by a firearm.
Now, of course, as a result of Port Arthur, there was a complete ban on long-arm semi-automatic guns, rifles, I suppose, but there wasn't a complete ban on semi-automatic pistols or handguns. Has there been, in terms of the various kinds of crime or homicides, has there been, within the reduced numbers, a shift from long-arm to handgun deaths?
Yeah, that's correct. As I said, overall, we've seen a reduction in homicides with the firearm in Australia, which is positive. The negative side to that, though, is that we have, since 91, seen a 36% increase in homicides committed with a handgun. We've also seen an increase of suicides committed with a handgun and also robberies committed with a handgun. I think the public did not know that after Port Arthur, there was not a blanket ban on all semi-automatic firearms. There was a ban on semi-automatic rifles and shotguns, but this did not adhere to semi-automatic handguns. One would say that semi-automatic handguns are more dangerous than semi-automatic rifles and long guns, mainly because they are preferred by people who use them for criminal activity because they are so easy to conceal and easy to carry around, particularly within urban areas. They're not as heavy as your rifles and you don't need a big bag to conceal them. They're particularly useful, I guess, for drive-by shootings as well because they're easy to use while you're driving or passenger of a car. They're easy to get out and draw. So in terms of the dangers of semi-automatic handguns, I would say they're probably more dangerous than semi-automatic long arms purely because of their concealability factor.
But it sounds like the kinds of crimes you're talking about there are not people who are, if you like, having one episode of a killing spree. You're talking about people involved in criminal endeavours. Those people, how do they get a hold of handguns, given that we do now have a lot of restrictions on their use, on their ownership, registration and those sorts of things?
Yeah, but in terms of ownership, it's not really useful to look at licensed and unlicensed gun owners. Not because licensed gun owners are the same as criminals, not at all. Many people own guns in the community, ranging from various occupations, and most of them are generally pretty nice folk. It's more to do with the fact that the more guns available in the community, the more likely they'll be stolen and fall into the black market. A study was done by the Australian Institute of Criminology on the theft of handguns or firearms in Australia, and the study did find that the majority of firearms fall into the black market by them being stolen from legitimate gun owners' homes, from firearms dealers, also from Navy and Army barracks, and also from security gun warehouses. So it's purely a practical way of looking at the situation. If you reduce the number of guns overall in the community, you reduce the likelihood of them being stolen and therefore reduce the likelihood of them moving into the black market in Australia.
Sam Lee, Chair of the National Coalition for Gun Control. I'm Damien Carrick and you're listening to The Law Report on ABC Radio National on this Anzac Tuesday.
Alexander, is this your handwriting here?
Yeah.
Alexander, it says you haven't done the reading because you were too busy doing the reading.
That's right. Can't do the reading if I'm too busy doing the reading to do the reading, can I? I haven't got time.
Why didn't you have time?
I was too busy reading.
Schoolboy Alexander's unique take on the dog ate my homework excuse. John Clark and Brian Dawes' interpretation of the continuing AWB Iraq kickback scandal. The Cole Inquiry is currently trying to sift the wheat from the chaff as to who knew what and when, and to track information flows between government departments and ministers. But what about information flows in and out of government? The opposition claims that freedom of information laws, which are designed to protect and promote transparency, are being undermined. Kelvin Thompson, the Shadow Minister for Public Accountability, says to date he's been unsuccessful in using FOI to obtain any documents relating to the AWB scandal.
I've asked for documents relating to Alexander Downer and his staff's dealings with AWB Limited in the years from 1997 to 2006 relating to wheat exports to Iraq, for Mark Vale and his staff's dealings with the Wheat Board during those years, and indeed Tim Fisher and his staff's dealings with the Wheat Board during those years. All of those requests are germane to the issue of how much ministers knew at the time regarding the kickbacks and what checks they made to ensure that Australia was not undermining the United Nations sanctions.
And what response have you received to the FOI request, specifically in relation to the communications between AWB and the various ministers' offices?
The Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade has denied my request for AWB documents, despite the requirement for a 30-day response time. It took a number of calls from my office and an extra week to extract an answer. The stated reason for the delay was that there was a hold-up in the minister's offices. Now, that, of course, gives rise to concern on my part that Minister Downer's office has been interfering in the FOI application process. And the basis of the denial of my request was the claim that this would substantially and unreasonably divert the resources of the department from its other operations. Now, my response to this is that the government has been claiming all along that it has given all the documents to the Coal Commission. Now, if they've already done the work of handing over documents to the Coal Commission, it can't be some substantial and unreasonable diversion of resources for them also to make these documents publicly available to me.
But presumably they could give documents to the Coal Inquiry, and there could be reasons why they might not be able to give some of those documents to you, I guess for commercial in confidence issues or perhaps national security issues.
Well, the government is claiming that it is being transparent and cooperative over the AWB kickback scandal. We've just had the AC Nielsen poll say that 72% of people polled think that the federal government was aware that AWB was paying kickbacks to Iraq despite the government's claim of ignorance. Now, one of the reasons why people are starting to doubt the label of Honest John is that the government has had to be dragged kicking and screaming to the truth about the kickback affair. It's given the Coal Inquiry restricted terms of reference. It's refused to allow Senate Estimates Committees to question departmental officials. And now it's using any excuse to block FOI applications.
Well, sticking to the FOI issue, what's been your response to the decision your request has been denied?
We've had 6 different requests put forward. We've resubmitted the primary FOI request excluding all documents given to the Coal and Volcker inquiries in order to establish whether all documents have been given to the Coal Inquiry, and we think that theoretically this request can't be denied on the basis of unreasonable burden. We've also submitted an FOI request on the processing of the FOI request that was denied in order to capture the Minister's Office's role in the delay and the FOI decision-making process. So we have been lodging a number of applications to seek to get to the bottom of the matter.
Kelvin Thompson, the Federal Shadow Opposition Minister for Public Accountability. 2 other FOI requests relating to AWB, lodged by his office, are still being considered. Rick Snell is an FOI expert and senior lecturer at the University of Tasmania Law School. He's not surprised by the department's rejection of Kelvin Thompson's requests. Snell sees it as part of a wider attempt by all governments, federal and state, Conservative and ALP, to neuter FOI schemes.
No, I'm not surprised. Disappointed, but certainly not surprised. The tendency of all Australian governments, but in particular this government since 1996, has been to really clamp down and make the use of FOI very restrictive.
Well, what about the argument that it would substantially or unreasonably divert the resources of the department from other operations?
That's a valid argument. It's a valid claim for exemption under the Freedom of Information Act. But the tribunals, when they've been applying this particular test, take into account a number of factors. And some of those factors are, one, just the ability to locate the information, given the fact that all this information has already been searched for and put together in order to deal with the Coal Commission, would indicate that it won't take too much time to find the information. Number 2 is that you take into account the size of the agency. With this particular agency, it has thousands of personnel in Canberra, and the allocation of 1 or 2 or 3 of those staff for a limited period of time wouldn't be an unreasonable diversion of the resources of a very large agency. 4, given that it's a public interest, given the nature of the information being requested, what's happening at the moment both within the Coal Commission and in terms of the discussions that are taking place in newspaper, within the Parliament, etc., this would seem to be a fairly high priority type of request to meet.
Well, the rejection letter said something like it would require going through 100 files totalling 7,444 folios. It would require 1,633 man hours to process by a qualified person. That does sound like a big resources commitment.
In some ways, but one, you have to look at in terms of, at that rate, that's around about 4.5 pages an hour that a qualified person is supposed to be processing this information at. Most of us process information at a much quicker rate than that. So I think this is deliberately erred on the kind of low side. Secondly, one of my critiques of the whole process is that the process is designed to default towards secrecy rather than defaulting towards openness. And by that I mean, in this particular case, they're taking this length period of time to process this request, or intend to process this request, in order to determine how much of this information not to release. Their main objective in the exercise is not to release as much information as possible and to identify just those areas that are really important to keep secret or confidential. The whole process is to try and find exemption for every single word, every single line, every single page in those 105 files. So the whole process has been effectively turned on its head from what was intended.
Presumably, though, there will be reasons why they can't just sort of press click on the print button and hand over everything that they gave to the Cole Inquiry. There might be reasons why the documents which were appropriate to give to the Cole Inquiry might not be appropriate to give to the ALP for national security reasons or for, I don't know, commercial and confidence reasons.
Yep, certainly. But in today's information age, you would have expected, then again, given the evidence given before the Cole Inquiry, maybe we shouldn't be surprised. But given the information technologies available, given the information management systems available, that information ought to be clearly identified at the start of when the information was created or in the processing for the Cole Inquiry, what is effectively the GUMF information and what is the secret, confidential and sensitive information ought to be highlighted. And so this actual process of release or non-release of information, by the time you put in an FOI request after these circumstances, should be fairly routine in the terms of processing information.
What are the consequences, as you see them, of what you would perceive as a general clamping down on in terms of FOI, a restriction of the scope and of the whole FOI scheme?
I think the first one is that it defeats the whole purpose and objective of the Act to make as much information publicly available as possible so that you get not only the best minds within the public service accessing the information and using the information, interrogating it, but you also get those outside the public service, journalists, opposition MPs, staffers, policy experts, etc., who can do the same process. And if we just take the example of the Cole Inquiry, if a lot of this material had been made publicly available long before the Cole Commission inquiry, Australia would have been saved $300 million in payment of bribes, a heap of international embarrassment, etc., because someone would have brought it to the attention of the powers that be that there was something fishy going on in this process.
So you're saying that if we had a more transparent government, state and federal, then we might avoid the kinds of AWB debacles?
Yes, because everyone would play the game much harder and better, i.e. the public service would be on their toes more, because if they overlook some sensitive information or if they overlook some critical information about the activities of a major Australian company in a sensitive international arena, if they didn't pick it up, that someone else more likely would be to pick it up, an expert in the field or a wheat board analysis or even our competitors, etc., and bring it to the attention of the government. Ministers would become aware much quicker that their faith in the Australian Wheat Board was unjustifiable in the circumstances.
Rick Snell, Senior Lecturer in Law at the University of Tasmania.
Saddam says you sold him some food.
Sold him food while we were attacking him?
Yes.
That doesn't even make sense.
None of this makes sense, John. He said he was the main buyer.
Anyway, Saddam's a crook.
How do you know that?
We had to bribe him to get him to buy the food.
I'm Damien Carrick and you're listening to The Law Report on ABC Radio National. Let's stick with issues around access to information, this time in the USA. Almost every day, the US Secretary of Defence Donald Rumsfeld and other key Bush advisers are facing calls to resign over their handling of the Iraq conflict and the war on terror. Just recently, six high-ranking former US generals joined the chorus for Rumsfeld to quit. The six generals form part of an unlikely group of dissidents, people within the military and government's own ranks. Since September 11, there have been a rash of books published by both active and former military and intelligence operatives, government analysts and security experts, critical of the US government during its campaign in Afghanistan and Iraq. And there have also been many documents and dossiers leaked, presumably by current employees or servicemen. The US government and its security bodies, such as the CIA, have gone into damage control, believing that the stream of insider tales is hurting its reputation. Previously cleared manuscripts are being reclassified as revealing national secrets. And as we'll hear, the CIA is also using the national security card to prevent evidence being heard in, of all things, an equal opportunity dispute. The Law Report's Anita Barrow talks to Mark Zaid, a Washington-based lawyer who specialises in national security and freedom of information litigation.
Anyone who has since left the employ of the CIA and tries to get a book published comes up against a much higher wall of the First Amendment here in the United States of trying to overcome that type of prohibition that the CIA would rather have in place. And they are now classifying or saying information is classified that never appeared to have been classified before. And it seems to be a concerted effort to ensure that those who formerly served with them keep their lips shut tight.
Now, you've dealt with a lot of cases dealing with insider tales. Can you outline a few of those cases, starting with your most recent, the Thomas Waters Jr. memoir, which is an insider's tale of post-9/11 spy class?
Sure. Thomas Waters joined the CIA in the first class they were trained post-9/11, but he penned a book during that time or afterwards of that time he was in. And it's actually a very positive book about the CIA. In fact, Tom Waters thought it would be able to be utilized as a recruitment tool. And the problems now that we're seeing with what's called the PRB, the Publications Review Board within the CIA, is that they would authorize the release of aspects. You would submit chapters for review, and the agency would tell you, you have to redact this, you have to modify that, for whatever reason, and it has to be of classified nature, but there are variances of that. And then those changes would have to be made, or you have to legally challenge them. What happened in Tom Waters' case is he submitted the manuscript, it was reviewed, changes were requested, changes were made, and the last set of them was just actually four words. Then he deleted or changed those four words. Then he took the manuscript and he had it sold to a major U.S. publisher. The problem, though, is in Tom Waters' case, what had previously been authorized for release as unclassified suddenly turned classified. The same text.
Almost half of it, I think, wasn't it? It was about 175 pages of the 376 pages was blacked out.
Exactly.
Why was this, do you think?
That's the good question. One can come up with a range of answers from incompetence and that different people are looking at it at different times and have different opinions, which doesn't justify that this can be done that way, or to just some deliberate policy that they're trying to sort of intimidate authors so that they would not have their books published or pursue any attempt to write books.
Now, you also handled the manuscript from Eric Saar, the former intelligence officer who worked in Guantanamo Bay, Inside the Wire, a military intelligence soldier's eyewitness account of life at Guantanamo was the name of his book. This is of particular interest to Australians because it confirms much of the evidence from Mamdou Habib, an Australian who was released from Guantanamo Bay last year. Stories of the so-called snatch squads with sexual interrogation techniques were used. Can you talk a little bit about that case?
That case actually was quite different. We did not have to go into litigation in that case, and it had to do primarily because the Defense Department was handling the review process and not the intelligence agencies. It was the military agency. And at the end of the day, it actually turned out to be very little classified information that was in the book. And ironically, what got the most press out of Eric Saar's book was when someone from within the Defense Department leaked pages from the book that discussed these sexual techniques that the interrogators were using against some of the detainees.
This is the techniques where sexual techniques were used to, in effect, to sexually torture Muslim males. For example, menstrual blood or tampons were left around, or women were dressed up as prostitutes and made to titillate the Muslim men, which is against their religion.
Yes. Someone within the Defense Department leaked about 9 pages of the book, and that was those 9 pages that discussed these sexual tactics, leaked those to the Associated Press. And we knew they were the Defense Department copies and not our copies because each page had been marked secret. It turns out, at the end of the process, none of the information in there actually was classified, but it brought to light all of these tactics.
Another interesting case, which perhaps is more unusual, is the case of Jeffrey Sterling, who we will talk to later. This was an EEO or equal opportunity case. How could such a case, which essentially is a case of racial discrimination, get caught up in national security issues with the state secrets privilege being invoked by the CIA?
Jeff Sterling was an operations officer. He was a spy He was a covert operations officer for the CIA, African-American, lawyer, joined in 1993, and there are racial problems within the CIA, I mean, as there is throughout the United States, but within the CIA as well, there are very few African-American operations officers, and he was told at one point after he was trained in Farsi that he was too big and black to go to places where Farsi was spoken. His response was, well, when did you first notice that?
Point blank, the CIA said to me that I kind of stick out as a big black guy speaking Farsi, meaning that I didn't have the capability to be clandestine.
So, Jeffrey Sterling, you were told that you couldn't do certain jobs because of the color of your skin.
As a big black guy speaking Farsi. I mean, those are the exact words that they used to my face.
Well, would you say that there were some areas of work that would be difficult to carry out?
Absolutely not. The image of the CIA officer throughout the world is certainly not one of color. Generally, the upstanding white gentleman with a blue blazer and khaki pants. I traveled in many places throughout the world, and no one ever suspected me of working for the CIA. I don't fit the profile. I didn't fit the profile then.
In fact, I suppose it could be argued that you could be even more covert, given your size and colour.
It wouldn't
be obvious that there'd be a big black American spy in their midst.
Absolutely. I was very good at my job and what I did. And as I said, no one ever suspected that I worked for the CIA.
Now, I understand that you took an equal opportunity case right through to the federal court and to the Supreme Court.
Yes.
And they found that you could probably prove a case of racial discrimination, but they dismissed it on the grounds that in order to prove your case, you'd have to reveal classified details of operations within the CIA.
The conclusion from the federal courts was that for my case to go forward, the national security of the United States would be placed in jeopardy.
And the Supreme Court agreed, I understand.
They refused to even hear the case.
Do you believe that you could have actually supported your case without revealing covert operations?
Absolutely.
How would you have done that?
It wasn't a situation of revealing exactly the operations I was involved in. We're talking more on a human resources aspect. It's like, well, Mr. Sterling applied for such and such a job. He had this many years in service. Why did he not receive the job? That's not revealing national security. That is revealing your human resources and the operations within your human resources, not clandestine operations that I was involved in.
Mark Zaid, to be fair, there have been some very damaging leaks which would put any organisation into defensive mode.
Absolutely. I mean, the discussion that we're having doesn't necessarily mean that there are not appropriate cases where the state secrets privilege would not apply. The issue that's happening now is that the U.S. government is using it to scuttle the entire case whatsoever without even answering the allegation. I mean, what kind of message does it send that if you go work for a U.S. intelligence agency, potentially sacrifice your life and that of your families even, but yet if something happens where you're treated poorly within the agency, you have no recourse? And that's what the U.S. government is doing right now, unfortunately, using 9/11 as a crutch by which to do that.
Lawyer Mark Zaid, and before him, his client, former CIA agent Jeffrey Sterling. They were speaking with Anita Barrow.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.